Hey, what's up, guys? Lucas Burnley here. You are listening to the Edge and Flow podcast, where we discuss the knife industry, manufacturing in small shops, sometimes big shops, family, hobbies, and everything related. I'm here with my co-host, TJ Schwartz. And yeah, we're going to kick it off. How's it going, TJ?
Going really good. It's technically my Saturday right now, but I
Oh,
came in,
nice.
drank a cup of coffee, nice quiet shop. Feels good.
That's good. How are you guys liking 410s? How long have you been doing that?
410s we've been doing since probably late last summer, so probably 6 or 8 months, something
And
like
it's
that.
working good.
Yeah, really, really good. I like it a lot.
Do you think it would scale with more employees? Like for you guys?
I think so. I think so. I mean, you look at like Chris Reeve knives, they're on 410s,
Yeah.
and they don't do swing shifts or anything. It's just 410s.
Yeah.
That's it. And so
So, wow, no swings. That's actually
I don't think
surprising.
so. Yeah, I think it's solid 410s.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I think the first time I had like encountered that was a buddy working at Sandia National Labs. And it was like, you're like, wait, what? You work 4 days a week? It works. I mean, now there's like a pretty big push to it. I don't know if you
Yeah.
like are hearing out on like any of the podcasts, but there's a bunch of industries that are really trying to like implement it.
Yeah. Well,
It makes perfect sense.
part of it is pretty much all the schools in Idaho are going to 410s or 4 days.
Oh, really?
And yeah, I was like the
From
schools
what
that
grade?
all of them.
Oh,
So
wow.
yeah, so I went to like our school district where I grew up was 410s through all the schools in the whole district starting in like 2006. They went to that or 2007 when I was in like sixth grade. And so my high school and middle school, all that was all 4 day weeks.
That's wild, actually.
Yeah, they've been doing that. It's been kind of a transition over the last like decade through like all of Idaho. So
Makes sense, man. 3 days, I don't know, 3 day weekends. It just like at this point, like being parents, like you really see like one extra day to like be able to get something accomplished before the kids are fully home for the weekend.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it is not inconsequential.
Yeah. Well, I think part of it with the schools is like, I mean, if you're in sports, especially like all the games are on Friday. And
Yeah.
so it's like Fridays for sports. You know what I mean? So it's not
Right.
like it's just totally gone, but it's like you get all
Yeah.
your work done and then it's game day and you go do your thing. You know what I mean? It's kind of cool.
I'm on a new type of schedule. Maybe you've heard of it. It's the 7/12s. It's really it's really
Nice.
been interesting. Hopefully I'm get off this as soon as I possibly can. But
Yeah.
I know you've probably been there too.
Yeah, the shop
Sometimes
news
you got to
got me.
do it.
Yeah, there are times. There's times when ball needs to roll.
You know, it's nice though. I mean, it's like, I guess it's like self-directed. The ability to do that is pretty valuable. Like when you really need to just push through something. Yeah. 410s is the goal, man. That is Maddie and I have been talking about it too. I just see like it's an efficiency thing, but you look from a business standpoint and I think sometimes it's hard for people to wrap their head around, like, okay, if you're paying people, like you need them there all of the time. But if you look at like constructs around work and like industrial revolution and how like, 8-hour workday came into play, like it starts to like look a little bit different. I recently just listened to a podcast where they were talking about apprenticeships in the US and like apprenticeships make crazy amount of sense, right? Because you're earning some amount of money in the in a trad in like a sense of a, like an industrial apprenticeship. You're earning money, you're developing the skill set with the expectation or the ability to stay on at that job at an increased pay rate. All over the world, it's pretty common. Western European world. Okay. In the United States, it's like a really hard fought battle because companies are like, no, we don't want to pay people if they don't have skills. And it's like, yeah, but you actually get them the skills and then they're better employees. Boker does it in Germany, which is a lot of the people that I work with like started there as teenagers out of high school in an apprenticeship program.
That's cool.
It's freaking cool, man. Like you look at it and you're like, okay, you can go work fast food or you can go and work in some industry that you're interested in and build a real grown up skill set.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I like that a lot. I'm gonna have to think that over. Yeah, like creating an on-ramp that involves like, cause I mean, anytime I envision hiring somebody, I always picture an on-ramp in my head, but it's like, if you call it an apprenticeship and actually outline it that way, then it's like, it's more literal. It's not just like theoretical on-ramp. It's like, no, this is the plan. This is what we're trying to do. This is how long we're going to, you know, do this for. And the word apprenticeship, like it fully defines it. And that's pretty cool.
I think there's different connotations too. Like if you look like, okay, early 2000s, like if you're a tattoo artist and like you're an apprentice, like you're basically, you know, not getting paid and you're doing work for free, right? There's industries where that was like kind of the case. There's the old school, like people talk about like an apprentice in a knife shop. It's kind of the same thing. It's like you work for free and you learn. I think the beauty of like the commercial apprentice is that like the expectation is that you will learn, but that is like with around like knife shops, when someone says like, hey, will you take an apprentice? They're for the most part, they're basically asking if you will teach them to make knives.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is like, okay, these are the skills you need to operate inside of this business. You will develop those. You will be paid, but it's not like I'm not giving you my time just to teach you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I think that's one of the reasons like small shops, it's actually, I think it's more difficult. Like once you're in a larger shop, if you had, like, if you imagine like a small team, it's easier to have someone working through teams, developing skill sets at like, and then working their way into like, maybe they work their way into like machining. It's funny. They gave like the example of like the CAA mailroom as like a kind of a corporate methodology of like, you start off in the mailroom, you learn that job, you move up jobs, and you're like working your way into being like a movie agent, which is really, really interesting. So it's like, it exists across like all kinds of fields, you know? I don't know. I've been thinking about it a lot. Cause I, like for us getting like another employee, like at this point, I would love to hire someone that has some like skin in the game from like the standpoint of like, maybe they're a student in like the CNC program in Redmond, or like maybe they work at the maker space here, where it's like, you've paid some dues of either like craft or like technical skills. And now you want to like, but you're not doing it maybe as a job, either you're still in school or you are doing something as a hobby. I think that's like a prime like ground for what, like you said, kind of like training, you know, bringing up.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. We're pretty set right now for hands in the shop, but I mean, I can envision the next round, what we're going to have to do. And I got really lucky with the guys I got right now, kind of fell into my lap, but it's like, I'm fully aware that that's not always going to happen. I'm going to have to look even harder, I think, in the future. That'll be fun.
You know, what's interesting too, is like team dynamics. I think that is one, because like you do have a really good team. So it's like basically anybody you hire has to be able to interact with your very good team.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's hard.
Yeah.
It's asking a lot.
Yeah. The human side is something that you don't really think about when you're first starting a business, but yeah.
Do you think there are like personality hires? Do you know about like that concept?
I think I can read between the lines, but like fleshed out.
Basically, like maybe it's someone whose their skill set they're not being hired solely on their skill set or like their resume. They're adding like a critical component of personality to a team. And I love that idea, actually. Because if you just have like a bunch of like like I don't know, the exact same type of employee with similar skill sets and personalities.
Yeah.
I can actually see, like, you throw in a little bit of like someone who's, I don't know, not cheerleader, but like someone who maybe
Yeah.
is like maintains a different like tempo.
Yeah, it changes the vibration of the whole
Yeah, it
thing. Yeah.
changes the vibration.
Yeah. No, that's valid for sure, 'cause people like that definitely exist.
Not a first hire.
Right. Not yet. That's true.
What's going on the shop?
So, we're building for Blade Show. Blade
Nice.
Show is just coming, it's crashing in through the window right now. It's getting close. And so we have a good plan. We added all the knives that we wanted to bring to our production workflow, like our spreadsheets. And so it's really nice to have that, because we can just add the knives, and for the most part, they just come into existence, because the spreadsheet is just what we look at every single day. I mean, dozens of times a day. So if it's on there, it's happening. So I've been watching and contributing, of course, to make sure that that is on track timeline wise. And it looks like, yeah, we're going to build all the knives that we conceived, and possibly maybe even a little bit more. So that's the manufacturing side of it's been totally reasonable and good. But the logistics of going to Blade Show, physically moving product, and I mean, quite a bit of product, enough to where we're definitely going to have to look at pallets versus boxes, or like how exactly are we going to
Oh,
do that?
wow.
And so moving the whole booth, I mean, it's 2,500 miles. And then I started to look at, travel. You can't just like fly from Boise to Atlanta and leave at like 5 a.m. and be there for, at noon so that you can set up that day. It's like
Right.
they're just coming from Boise to Atlanta, you're losing an entire day. Like
I fly in Wednesday,
yeah,
like
exactly.
for
Same, so do
instance,
we. Yeah. So
right?
I'd
So.
love to fly in Thursday. Like, that'd be so much better, but have to fly Wednesday. And I'd love to fly out like after the show, which is what I always would do.
Yep.
Can't do it. Have to fly out Monday. So it's like, 5 nights. So it's just breathing down my neck a little bit of like tackling this beast, just from a logistical and just details standpoint. Fortunately though, having the products is not such a deal. It doesn't seem like.
It's amazing. There, I don't know, man, with shows, it's like there's always, if you have the product, there's the logistics. Like there's, I'm sure there's a way to do a show easy. And in a certain way, this is like one of the least stressed years I've ever had
Wow.
doing Atlanta, which does not actually make sense. And we can like go into that soon. But I think like with a show like Blade, you're 2,500 miles. Like it starts to get to a point where you're like, there's two of you. You're like, man, do we just drive?
Yeah,
Because in a
exactly.
certain way, like you're like, I can load all of our product. I can load our booth setup. We can leave. It takes this long. And you have control over every step of the
Yeah.
way. I'm sure like slightly higher overall risk, but it doesn't feel like it because you're self-controlled.
Yeah.
Man, because that is always like my least favorite part. And I'm bringing like one Pelican case usually.
Yeah.
You know, are you going to palletize this year? Like, do you pallet your booth and your product?
So, like I said, we have all those knives planned out. I was considering ways, because obviously if you put the knife in a box, it takes up more like cubic volume.
Yeah.
But if you don't put it in a box, how do you move that many knives?
Right.
And so it's I we're we've been boxing them. And so I
Yeah.
think if we box them all, I kind of have a visual of how big I think that is going to be, like volumetric space.
Okay.
But I think I'm just once we have like most all of it ready, I do have a pallet sitting here in the shop, and then obviously I can go get some boxes. And I'm gonna probably experiment after that to see, like, get some quotes, get some dimensions, see like what are we looking at here as far as overall size. Because it is a little bit hard to guess on that until you have everything sitting in front of you on
Right.
what's the shape. But a pallet, like, it just comes down to price. You know what I mean? Are we sending a bunch of UPS boxes that each weigh like 40 pounds, or are we just sending?
I hate that idea.
Yeah.
I mean, that's last time. So we've always done like the Pelican case with a pistol. Okay. Any airport that I can fly into, like with a handgun. And the reason for that is essentially that you check a firearm, just like if you're on a hunting trip, right? And they watch it from point A to point B.
Yeah.
They watch you lock it with non-TSA locks, and then it goes on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But it also adds a level of stress. Like last year, they had a gate agent that was like unfamiliar with the process. And they were basically telling me, they're like, no, the firearm has to be in a locked box by itself. And I've got it in a huge Pelican case with product. And I'm explaining, and like, they're getting frustrated and I'm getting frustrated. And I was like, listen, like, please just run this up the chain until you find someone who has like dealt with this before, because like, I've done this for a decade. I assure you that it is by the books.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to like get in an argument, but I also like, have to have this get on the plane.
Yeah. And what do you want me to do? Throw my gun in the trash can?
And I asked, I was like, what is the, they're like, well, next time bring a lockbox for your gun. And I was like, okay. And I went and I just bought one of like the little life pods. And I was like, I will now carry that also, because they, for some reason, like didn't understand like this large case
with a smaller gun
is a locking case. I could just have that rattling around. It's still satisfying the need.
Yeah. Okay.
So tangent there, but that has been the best way so far to travel to shows. Mm-hmm. You just can't do it if you're like flying to New Jersey.
Yeah. And the only problem we have is like, we just have too many knives. There's just there's no way we could get them on the plane with us. You know what I mean?
That's a question. So like last year I was actually, I was flying into Texas this year. The people in front of me on the lift, they had probably 6 Pelican cases.
Mm.
Big Pelican cases.
Interesting.
So if you were to think about like knives unboxed, slotted into foam in Pelican cases, does that rule hold? It's like, because you could go deep, possible. You could go wide. There's a lot of variations.
That's possible. Yeah, I guess I, for some reason in my head, thought that they had limits on how many you could check.
No, I mean, it's just like expensive.
Just paying. Yeah. I mean, but yeah, it's not going to be more than interesting. I might have to think about that.
The other thing is like, I'm terrified of losing product. So yeah. I've done things like ship half overnight, FedEx, take half on the plane with me.
Yeah.
Cause there's just, I know too many people that have like, you just get to the show and like, there's a shipping delay or a bag gets lost on a plane. Like all of it happens.
Yeah.
And like, sometimes it happens to like big companies.
Yeah. You're easing my nerves, man.
I like to think so.
No, this kind of stuff though, this, like, okay, I can look in my shop and be like, we can make the knives. We can go down there. I can imagine us selling knives, but from A to B, it's like, I'm excited to be there. I'm not excited to go there. You know what I mean?
Did you think about driving?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's crossed my mind, but
it's a lot. It adds so many days.
Yeah. It's the cost of like shutting the shop down for that much longer is unreasonable.
And you're away from your family. It's actually super. The first year I did Blade, I rode with a car full of knife makers, and it's like still one of my most memorable trips. It was super fun.
Yeah, that does sound cool.
Like,
and but, I keep thinking about Blade Show West, where it was like, it's 4 hours on the freeway.
Yeah.
Shove everything in the back of the Jeep, rip, you know, rip into the parking garage, grab everything out, take it in. I'm like, that it's, I love Blade Atlanta. I've been there pretty much every year, you know, COVID notwithstanding, and I'm really excited to exhibit there, but like, man, it is tough. You know what I mean? Tough. It's like, it's a headache. It's such a headache.
I think overall gut response would be that Pallet with a freight company is probably the safest, least stressful method. Mm-hmm. It also probably means that you should buy a forklift, which is awesome.
So the good news is there's in this same block that I'm in, city block, there's a feed store.
Oh, nice.
And they have, you know, pallets and pallets of like whatever, chicken scratch and stuff. And they have a forklift that's like a, you know, 6,000 or 7,000 pound forklift. And I went over there. They're like, yeah, dude, if you want to just take the keys.
Oh, amazing.
Honestly, I don't think I would do that. I don't know about, I don't know. I'm nervous. I don't like borrowing stuff that way.
Yeah.
But he multiple times he's brought it over here and moved stuff for
Sure,
us.
he'd move something for you. I think that the nice thing about that is you get to pack everything in your space. We were using Shipping Fulfillment Center for a while, and they had that as an option. And like just knowing that I could take product in, have it palletized and shipped from their location, I never did it. But it like was this weird stress relief because I was like, oh wow, that like just seems so nice, as opposed to using like UPS or FedEx to ship a bunch of product. One tangential story on this, a few years ago, great story. Unnamed company, unnamed employee, knives for the show were being sent by UPS and got dropped off at USPS. Something like $100,000 worth of product. So employee took them like end of week before the show to drop off, took them to the wrong shipping company.
Oh no. And so they just sat.
Yeah. Definitely a personality hire.
Yeah.
But
Yeah.
rough,
That's
man. Yeah.
rough.
So no product.
That's probably my we were gonna talk also a little bit about how we're both teaching courses.
Yeah.
It doesn't make I'm not I don't really have an issue with like public speaking. I'm really excited for it. I don't feel like I've written down enough of my material. So I think I'm going to set aside like a full day one of these weekends, probably this weekend, and just write and make sure that I've like reiterated in my head like exactly the outline and I want to do a handout. But
Yeah.
other than that, the only thing that's stressing me out is the shipping. So it's like if I can get the
Yeah.
shipping done and I can show up, get in an Uber and get to the place and my knives are there, I'm good. Because if
You're
on the
good.
way back, if they get delayed for 2 weeks or whatever, what I
Yeah.
don't care,
The
but
big ones that I do is, so I split boxes, right? I never ship all the product in one box. I insure for full value and I always ship overnight. I want it in the air for as short a time as possible, and I want it as safe as possible. And we almost always use FedEx because we've just had like the best luck with them. So it's tricky, man. It really is. And especially because you're at your scale, you're bringing steel. Like you're not, it's not something that is like one extra bag, you know, or case.
I was thinking, what if I ship each individual knife flat rate and it's just like a swarm of knives, like it's just a pile.
That's a hilarious idea.
That way, if there's
There's got to
attrition.
be, yeah. Or like, yeah, there's got to be like ways. It's like it would be sick to know like someone who's doing like coast to coast car moving or something, or like there's some other freight where it's like connected and you're like, all right, these are going with you, or like in this semi, like.
You know, dude, something just occurred to me. Tim Reeve. I should hit him up.
I mean, you should.
Yeah, I don't know why I didn't think about that. But yeah, I'm gonna talk to Tim. He's probably
All
moving
right.
pallets down there. Might have to
Tie on.
hook a little
It's in it. I mean, once again,
I don't
man,
know.
that's like the beauty of friends. Sometimes it's like things work out like that. I don't know.
So
I
that's
still
what's
think you
on
should
my
buy a
mind.
forklift.
Yeah, that's true. What's on your mind though? I know you're having a week, in a good way.
Yeah, man, I honestly, I was trying to figure out when I started this project, and I'm not even 100% certain. I know that I've been working 7 days a week for all of this month. So I'm working on the Keyhan fixed blade, with, I've given it the working title of K Field, Keyhan Field, which I kind of like it. I don't know. That name might actually stick. K
That's
Field has
cool.
like a kind of a good ring to it. But this has been the most active learning I've done in many, many years. And by active, I mean like I feel like I've just been like waterboarded with information for like the last month. And what's crazy is it's gotten broken up because like the design of the fixed blade happened last year, like as we were working through like fusion tutoring mm-hmm. stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so this was basically the first knife that I did like primarily on my own and would call you when I would get like stuck or like work through things. How I decided to bring this one into production a month before Atlanta is beyond me. I guess it actually tracks. Like the only thing I can think is like, this is a full on ADHD response, which is like, oh, there's a deadline. There's stress. Why now I'm super motivated to like mm-hmm. solve this problem that like I haven't made time for.
Mm-hmm.
And then fitting a project that was probably twice that should have had twice as much time around it into the time available. That said, I am like home stretch tail end of this thing. And like, it looks like, knock on wood, it's going to work and work in time. And I might actually have some knives at blade.
That's great.
But it brings up like a really big question for me. And I haven't been able to like come up with my answer to it yet, which is like, it doesn't matter if I did it the right way or not. Okay. Like it's as far as how many things I tried to do at once, but was it better? Like, was it better that I essentially was doing a new model in new software with new cam, a new fixturing process, a new palette system, and like having to work through all of that stuff simultaneously? Or would it have been better to like break that up and like learn how to use my Pearson palette first?
I could think of pros and cons for both, but
yeah,
I think now that you're on the downhill side of it, I think just doing it all is probably the best, because
that's what I'm feeling like.
Problem is, you take a step forward with one and you're basically adapting it onto what you're already doing in some way.
Yeah.
And then now you've got like a mixture of like old fashioned and new. And right. So you're making some sort of compromise in doing that. And then eventually yeah. You're just going to get to where you're like, all right, I'm happy with this compromise. And then 3 years later, you're like, well, I'm still compromising.
100%. And that yeah. is what I've done with almost every system that I've brought in over the last decade. And it's a needs must thing. You're like, all right, I know I can create this efficiency, but I just need it to work right now.
Mm-hmm.
And then right now turns into 4 years because mm-hmm. you actually just have to work and make money. And like, yeah. you don't magically find a bunch of extra time. It's almost like at the point where you are starting to do something uncomfortable, it's probably better just to go for myself. I think this is probably a methodology of like, I'm going to pay now and this is going to hurt,
mm-hmm.
but it's going to hurt for less time
yeah.
in the long run and yield better results. Like I look at this, this is game changing for our business and our family in reality, like not to put too fine of a point on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's taken me this long to get to this point. And that's crazy to me. But once I was in it, it was like a month.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
there's a pretty big intimidation factor with what you've done. And it's pretty cool to see what you have pulled off. It's honestly, looking at that knife, you sent me the picture, I think last night or yesterday or something. Fantastic, man. That's really cool. Dude.
Could not have done this without you. And so I don't know, like I've been thinking a lot about like friends and networks and like our industry lately. And I just like, I realize how much effect these relationships have like on other people in our industry. I'm like, just, it's weird because like we teach things, right? And, or like show techniques or like talk with people about something. And like, you don't like I'm being completely genuine and like that this model will probably change the entire course of my business,
mm-hmm. yeah.
which affects my family's life. Mm-hmm. And that mm-hmm. to me is like, that's wild. Because it's easy to be like, well, yeah, cool. Yeah, I'm glad I like showed you some stuff. And you're like, but to have that direct of like a course change, I think that's pretty cool. I think that is special to our, I think small, probably small industries like this, but I have never felt so stupid in my life or so frustrated, I don't think, because this has been like, I mean, there were days where I literally sat for 5 hours trying to like solve, like understand why like a tool path wasn't working. And for as much as I called you, I was doing like my utter best to like not call and like to solve things. So it's like by the time that I would call, I was basically had just been like banging my head on the counter for, you know, a day. And it's like you're sitting there staring at screens and you're like, I know that there's a parameter or a setting or like it's picking up some geometry that I'm not seeing. And it's one click, it's one button somewhere, and I can't find it. Like,
I know exactly what you mean. It's I think anybody who's Fusion and probably any CAM in general, it's like CAM is a negotiation.
ooh, that's
It's
interesting.
you're not really telling in like designing in CAD, it's if you're pretty good at it, it's more of like you can tell it what to do. Like you can tell it exactly what you want. Whereas in CAM, there is like a, it's not AI, but it's sort of like that. There's an intelligence between you and the actual tool path that you're trying to talk into doing what you are wanting
Right.
because it's trying to generate code for you. You're not writing the code. And so it's like if you're using a flow tool path, you're like, no,
Right.
I want you to flow over this ridge, this parallel, doing this direction, blah, blah, blah. Why won't you do it? And you're like,
Yeah.
you know, trying to coerce it into doing what you're trying to say. And I've noticed that too. It's like each of those tool paths that you can select has its own little personality. And
Yeah.
you start to realize, like when you were showing me the ramp tool path doing that weird little like jump around move it does, and it's like I can see that and think it's almost like a person, you know, it's like, oh, that, you know, they're in that mood again. Like you need to select this, you need to, you know, try this. Sometimes if the lines aren't totally parallel, whatever, it'll do that. You know, it's like it's very suggestive.
For reference, guys, like I was trying to do a straight line and it basically looked like I had a spire graph and I could not, like, I'm everything that I'm trying, I'm like, I don't even understand like what it's doing. Like, very tempting just to run it in the air because it would have
See
been
what it looks
wild.
like.
But I mean, yeah, it and that across multiple, like I think the frustration points or like just like this sense of not like defeat, but like literal just like mental exhaustion. Like I would come in at night and I would sit at the table and like I wouldn't be able to talk because I was like I just didn't have anything left, which I hate that, right? But it's short. This is like the short term. And it's like this is where you put in the time so that like I'm not coming in tired
And
every day.
like I said, the power now is not only do you have like that muscle memory, but
Yeah.
if you've created that fixture and created all those programs in Fusion,
Yeah.
next time around, copy paste.
It's crazy.
And then you just reselect geometry. And if it doesn't work, you just go back to the last one and say,
Yeah.
okay, oh, that sketch was on this plane instead of this plane. That's why it's not working. You know what I
Yeah,
mean?
like fit in the next project has to be 50% easier just by
Or
a
more.
basic margin. And that's not even taking into account like my understanding of it. I think the other interesting aspect of this is that in a way, if I had like taken on smaller pieces, I probably would have had those pieces be more successful and less frustrating throughout the course of the project. But I actually think that like the amount of problems that I ran into, and we had talked about this a little bit, I think I was like solving the problems made me understand what was happening at like a more complete level. Because I had not only am I doing the thing, now I have to correct the thing that I messed up. Like I destroyed a fixture okay, what happened? But in that process, like I also improved my surface finish on the next fixture. Like the tapping, I've never rigid tapped on a machine. And it's like, if you're a machinist and you're listening to this, you're like, oh, rigid tapping is like super easy. Spinning a tap into a big plate and not understanding like the parameters is terrifying. I had PTSD running everyone in at the end because I was just waiting for the pop. And like it would pop and like my body, I would just have that like fight or flight response.
Yeah. No, I've had that experience where like if you're hanging out, if somebody's in your shop who hasn't like run CNC machines before, and you're like having a conversation and you're like putting your USB stick in, you're loading the program, and then it's like you're having a conversation and then you hit cycle start. It's like almost panic. It's like on the movies where like your ears just start ringing and like the whole world just sort of like fades. That's what it's like when it's a new program, when it's something that you haven't done before. It's like everything just wipes away. It's like is hand on the feed holder, e-stop, and it's just, yeah, it's tense. I've felt that before. I'm a little better than I used to be, but yeah.
Yeah, and you get comfortable. You get comfortable with the things you're comfortable with. I think too, you know, it's funny, like being in a small industry and having, there's still so many unknowns for people around CNC. Like I just had someone recently like make the green button joke. It's like, oh yeah, you like push the green button and like the parts come out. And I was like, oh, that's old technology. Like I push the green button and it comes out ready to ship. Right. And the crazy thing is like in a small shop where you have a few people and you're doing the programming, you're doing the fixture design. Like there's two things that have made me feel completely different as a craftsperson. The first where I was like tangibly noticed, like, oh, I feel like a better craftsman. The first was when I did that 2-week bladesmithing course. I left thinking like, I'm a better craftsman for that. I understand material and like process in a different way than I did before. In this round of CNC CAD CAM fixturing, like process had the exact same effect.
That's awesome.
Right. It's pretty. So, and I arguably, I think I've learned. So when I first got into CNC, I basically had a friend help me set up, get one model ready to run. And then I became an operator and ran that model for like a year or two before I really even designed anything else. But as I added design in, it was stacking on those skills and it was never about pushing. It was like, just about like, here's the knife I want to make. Here's how I know how to make it. I make my parts. I move on.
You know what I hear when you're saying that?
Yeah. What do you hear?
The process is the product.
The process is the product.
You got a new process, my friend.
It's mind blowing.
And it's
a paradigm shift.
It's also further indication that when I say that, like a machine is not a process.
No.
You know what I mean? Like
it's
so
much.
You can
use it any way you want.
Yeah. There's so much more that goes into it. And like now that you have this recipe top to bottom, left to right of how to get that fixed blade to come into existence.
Yeah.
It's the CNC mill is just like a pawn on that board. You know what I mean? Yep. It's just part of it, you know?
Yeah. It's very satisfying. Like I look and as I was doing this, I'm like, I could outsource this. Like I know I could do this as like a mid-tech. And like, I was thinking specifically about the Huck. Okay. Because for all intents and purposes, structurally it's like the same knife. It is a full tang field knife with shadow box scales and, you know, like a utilitarian finish and a Kydex sheet, right? The way that I feel about this compared to that is, I mean, it's like diametrically opposed. And like the satisfaction that I get when I'm like looking at the parts from this, and it's because like I make things. And that to me, I'm like, this is a different way of making, but it's still me making, and I feel super connected to it. And I don't know. It's pretty, it's pretty exciting, man. So basically the last thing I have on this knife is 3D machining the scales, which like at this point feels fairly approachable.
Yeah. And the nice thing is you don't actually need a fixture to do that. And you can, your older method is how I started.
Yeah.
So like that YouTube video you watched of mine, that's basically what you do.
Yeah.
And so it's like, that worked for me for a while, and it's not like long-term the best way to do it, but the result is the same, like just a little bit slower.
Yeah. It's a prototype method, not a production method, but for small run production, it also works great. Or like, and this is something that, I think Jens had said this a long time ago and it really stuck. I remember he was, we were talking about CNC and I forget the context, but he basically made the comment that like he had stopped looking at the CNC as something different. And he's like, yeah, now I just like use it as a tool. And I understood what he meant, because it's like, once you know how to use a drill press and you understand like it's functioning, you can throw a flap wheel in it and understand that it's going to work. You're using it almost in like the wrong way, but to achieve a result. And he was doing something where I was like, oh wow, you did that on the mill? And it's like something he would normally like do by hand. It was like really simple. It might have been diamond dragging.
I was gonna say, I bet it's a diamond logo. Drag. Yeah, versus the pantograph.
And like, I love pantographs. Okay. To me, at that point, the thought of being able to like put a knife in the CNC and have like a spring-loaded diamond drag do the logo, I was like terrified of that for some reason. I don't even know how to turn my spindle off and just do that. And that's where he's like, yeah, I just use it as a tool. So I have this fixture and I put the blade in, I press cycle start, it engraves the blade, and it gives me better result than my pantograph. I think that is like the goal with some of this stuff, is like true understanding. It also brings something else into play, which is like, okay, if you think about apprenticeship, right? Apprenticeship, you are working in a business, learning the business. There is a point where you are not like actively learning. You are now an employee. Okay. In our own businesses, you get to those points where like right now, I feel like this is both like a culmination of some skill sets, but also the beginning of refinement of those skill sets. But I don't, like, I look and I'm like, okay, is there another big jump down the line? Is it, because like at some point you probably do actually stop making huge like paradigm shifting growth, right? Or is that like for you, since like, you know, going back to our namesake of the pod, like with finding the edge, do you feel that you will constantly push your skill set? Or is there a point where you're like, this is what this skill set satisfies this business?
That's a great question. No, that's something I've had to play with in my head a lot, because we've been engineering a system here that's been working really good and we're doing the fine tuning of it right now. And obviously getting into the new shop has allowed for a whole new round of fine tuning, and I'm happy with that. But I've had this side eye on like the next big jump, like what's the move, what's the playbook look like, you know what I mean? And I don't know, I'm chewing on that a lot of like, it's not always like, you can't be the person who's always doing the novel thing, or you can, but for me it's like that's not going to work long term for me, is like just always doing new. And I don't know that it's super healthy for me to be thinking that way either. Because I think stopping and distilling a process and perfecting it is very satisfying to me. And it also yields a result of like, you're just going to improve something to the best it can be in the way that it already exists. You know what I mean? So you look at like Chris Reeve, you know, Chris Reeve knives, the Sebenza, you look at K-Bar, you look at the old trench knife, you look at, you know, like these are products that have been distilled over generations. You know what I mean? And that doesn't happen if you're always novel,
moving past.
And a lot of like novel things are sometimes, you know, only 2/3 of the way through their product development cycle before the next thing starts.
Yeah.
So you see, there are businesses that just live like that, that just churn ideas and get it to where it's like satisfactory, and then it's a new idea.
Knew it, yeah.
But then you've got companies that follow those companies that mature those products to 100%. And I've always looked at Apple that way. Like a lot of like Samsung and stuff is like Samsung, LG, Motorola. Like they felt like they always did a lot of the innovation, not always, but a lot of new features were coming from these other companies. But it's like Apple's waiting behind to find what's the best and then mature it to
and
a level that they,
on it.
Yeah, that they never ever conceived to mature it to that point. And there's definitely value in that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so, just it's a different process, but
yeah. So yeah, I think a mixture, but I think like I want what I'm doing to be mature enough that I'm not just like going off into the weeds, leaving something unfinished. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that is like naturally, that is the easy thing for me to do, which is like start something based on hyper focus, take it to a point, get bored, move on. There was periods of time in my life where it actually worked really well. And I think there's a level of success that it actually afforded me. But it fits into my world less now, and the stakes and the consequences are higher. Mm-hmm. So I think for the way that I have been looking at it is kind of like a Pareto's law, 80-20 rule almost, where it's like, if I can make 80% of what I consider the business to be like very efficient, I have 20% that maybe is just for me.
Mm-hmm.
Where I can keep that like experimental, developmental kind of inquisitive process going. Mm-hmm. Because I do think that that is like kind of my fuel. And I don't see a version. I don't see a version where I feel like if I let that go, I will slowly die.
Yeah.
Basically, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like I would just not be in a position I wanted. It's funny, you and I were going to touch on this, I think, last pod. The shop space thing. This is over 6 years, we've moved twice. I went from home shop to commercial shop to back to home shop. And I realized that I've never actually had a home shop at this type of life, in this type of life, which is two kids of a certain age, the demands around that, working with Maddie. And like, we just recently started talking about a commercial space again. And it's like twofold. So one, basically this knife and this process allows me to think about hiring an employee again.
Mm-hmm.
Because for a while it was almost like apprenticeship level where I have to transfer all of my skills for you to do like a task.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Shout out to Joe Mangifico for being an all-star. It also ties in with like the fact that at this point, like my home shop is truly like my cave of solitude. But for my kids too. And like, I look and I'm like, I can't reconcile how I can be efficient in my home shop and like have an employee or two, and then also have at the shop where I can like do projects with my kids.
Mm-hmm.
I look and I'm like, all right, I've got like gunsmithing projects. I've got jewelry stuff. I've got like all of like my hobby interests, and I've got like art on the walls and like all of these like different components. And I'm seeing it that I really, really want that. And I want efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like the first time where they're actually feeling like they're very separate.
Yeah. No, I think we've talked about this a little bit before, but yeah, the having like fun and games in a place that's, I mean, obviously work can be fun. You know, we all know that, but like true fun and games is awesome.
Yeah.
You mix it with something that's supposed to be serious and efficient.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can, it may not be like very obvious, like what's happening, but it's, you're both are getting watered down.
They're both getting watered down. That's the thing. It's like, I don't want to bring someone in and then have to be like, dude, this like workbench, like what is this even?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh, I was taking apart, I don't know, a scooter for my kid.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a different, or like not wanting to bring them in to work because it's like, oh man, like, okay, I've got production stuff on all these tables and like, you want to build like a big Lego project or we want to like do some woodworking. And I'm seeing this as like, I see it as like a stage of life where it's like, so Bo and I have been doing archery together. It's not lost on me that we call him Bo. I've been calling him B and then talking about Bo's cause I hate saying the same word twice, but so we've been doing archery together and like, I got Maddie a bow. I have two bows. Barlow has a bow. And I'm like, I would really like a bow press. I have gunsmithing stuff. I've got like, you know, vices that are, and I look and I'm like, this is a point in life where this now is becoming a problem. If I want to have this space being super productive, cause it's mm-hmm. like, how do I reconcile both, you know? Mm-hmm. Or like, I went through my shop and I'm like, 60% of the drawers are like your standard, maybe not even like standard, but like old school knife maker.
Yeah.
Okay. It's got random handle materials, random hardware, old knife blanks, like things that I found interesting. I compiled them all and kind of put them into what I consider like my cabinet of curiosities
mm-hmm.
in the sake of trying to make it to where like, here's my steel, here's my Kydex, here's like my folder parts, here's the stuff that needs to be efficient. And it bothered me.
Mm-hmm.
It bothered me because I'm like, this is, I'm relegating a part of like who I am and like this, my attachment to all of this to like an area because I'm wanting it to be tidier and it won't get there. Like the two things don't go hand in hand.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So I don't know. It's just a newer thought because like for a while, the having a shop away seemed like a burden, but I was looking, I was like, man, when we were on Cape and we had the commercial shop, I didn't have a home shop and we only had Bo and he was super small and like he could come in and hang out and we had enough space that it was like, it was still like a funky shop in an area, but then had like the big efficient space.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
It's subdivided in inside of one building.
Subdivided. And this, like I see it, I'm like, oh, there's bleed. So this is the first time where I'm like, it's working really well for what it is now. I'm super grateful for my shop space. I want a new CNC. I feel like at this point, the process and a new CNC probably start to push into a commercial space.
Yeah. So Silex 7, is that what we're thinking?
I am really, really thinking. So at some point I want to sit down with you and do a spec for spec. Haas just released a new mini mill
mm-hmm.
that is pretty good.
Yeah.
From a spec. It like does, but here's the thing. Like I am still like kind of team Haas because of the support and because mm-hmm. of my fear of like crashing a machine. I want like, I basically want, you know, the Haas man to come down with the van,
mm-hmm.
you know, and fix it.
Yeah.
I'm scared of crashing a Sile and then having like a lot of downtime. Mm-hmm. That said, I've had the same mill since like 2010. I've never had problems, knock on wood. I've fixed the few little things that I have had. And the money difference is real.
Mm-hmm.
But where I had not been interested in the mini mill because of like some of the funky features, they've corrected some of that. And it's
they improved
pretty
it a lot from what I've seen.
Improved it a lot.
The auxiliary coolant tank, I think, is huge.
That's
huge.
Like one of the only things I ever hear people with mini mills complain about. And now like, so you can get, I don't have to get a super mini. I can still get a 10K spindle. I can get a 20 tool changer. Like you can get all of the things,
mm-hmm.
but it, and I can look at the Haas and I can understand like what options I'm looking at and what, like I look at the Sile and I'm like, I don't know which controller I want.
Yeah.
because I'm used to, can I get the Haas controller?
Yeah.
Right. So it's funny though, because I've been sending you messages from my buddy who is looking at buying a new machine, and he like swung around to Sile, and he's like a good machinist,
mm-hmm.
and like works for a really good company and is like a very good designer. So like the fact that he's also looking at it, it's like, but his concerns out of the gate were exactly the same.
Yeah. Yeah. And same.
He's like,
mine.
It's worth it. It's worth it for the premium to have the support. He talked to Titans. I wonder, do you know anything, like, are they developing like a support system? What is the current support system?
So the whole Titans of CNC thing is interesting. I have not involved, I've watched the videos, but yeah. I bought my original Sile from Sile Direct.
Right.
I bought the X9 that is still being built.
Yep.
Direct. So right. I have not, even though Titan had already announced their situation, like I, even after that, I still
yeah,
bought
you already
X9.
Had the pathway.
Just because, yeah, I know Jeff over there in Oregon, I think he is actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. He's like the Northwest guy for Sile. Really, really cool guy. So I just went back to him, and he's direct sales. But the way tech support currently works is you basically reach out directly. They've got a phone number to a couple different people. They've got a couple of guy, like American guys, that are just on staff. A lot of them, I think, are like long-term Sile owners that are right. also like machine shop owners that they like, they basically, because that they believed in the Sile brand, they were able to like hire them directly to work for Sile.
Yeah,
so it's like
that,
they have like past
sense.
Experience. And so that it's like they're answering questions, but they're not necessarily like classically trained by Sile. So it's like, if you get through that filter and they're like, you know what, I don't know, then they'll throw you on a call directly with an engineer for Sile, like actually at their factory, like the actual mm-hmm. people that designed it. So the beauty of that is like, you are on an island where you do have to like do some legwork, but if you have a big enough problem, you can talk directly to the CEO of Sile to solve the problem.
Right. Like, but I can, you don't, but you are not going to have someone come and do it, like yeah. change a spindle for you.
Correct. Correct.
I wonder if they will add that. I mean, cause I know there's like, there are techs that work on multiple CNC.
Yeah.
You know,
you could hire like a general CNC technician. It's not going to be a Haas guy. I don't think they're going to let that happen, but
yeah, of course.
But yeah, you could, cause like a spindle cartridge is very easy to you. I won't say easy. It's a very doable DIY. And if you found somebody who's like refurbed Fidals a few times
right.
and you
they
said, hey,
do
put
that.
This spindle
yeah.
cartridge in, easy. Like yeah. there's not CNC mills. There's not that much going on mechanically with them.
Sure.
There's some, but like, I mean, like a Toyota Civic or a Honda Civic or a, you know, an old Toyota, they're way more complicated than a CNC mill. You know
right.
what I mean? So it's like, if you can imagine working on an old car, CNC mills are way simpler to
yeah.
work on.
And
So,
and we're talking like there are smaller machines.
Yeah.
And like, again, the price differential, that's basically what I want to do, is sit down with you, build out an X7 with all the features that you think and I think I should have.
Mm.
Right. And then comparably do that with the Mini
mm-hmm.
and see one where the overlap is, if one's providing a lot that the other isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And two, like where that comes in at a price. Like I built out a Mini just for fun, and it came out to like 68,000, but it had a lot.
And it wasn't the Super Mini.
Wasn't the Super, but it, but
so
in 10, that 000. It had the 10,000 RPM spindle. It had the 20 tool changer. I mean, it had probing. It mm-hmm. had everything that I could possibly want. Chip auger. It had everything.
Mm-hmm.
And 60. I look and I'm like, for, it was like 68 or 69.
Okay.
Okay.
Sounds about right. So yeah.
So
I'd have to go, because the auger and stuff, I never spec that.
Right. That's like, it's like apples to apples. That's what I need.
Yeah.
I can look and I can be like, wow, this is really inexpensive.
So
by the time you feature it, I just want to make sure that what I'm comparing
yeah.
is the same.
Yeah. 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 No, that's valid. I've never priced out some of those other features. I've priced out like probing or something. Like,
yeah.
Right now, like an X7 with the control that you want, which is the Syntec.
Uh-huh.
Like the sticker price if with no other options is like 36.
Right.
And that's where it starts. And then each option is less than the equivalent Haas option.
Right.
But they're not all exactly the same options is also right. what you're saying. It's like the biggest tool changer on the style is the 16 on the X7. Right. So right. it's like, yeah, 16 versus 20.
Right.
You know, there's a,
you start yeah, there, to like, you start to a little like bit leverage. Of nuance.
Yeah.
Then there's also the fact that like, in some ways Haas is like Harley and like, they'll do this stuff where they're like, cool, 84 month. Like you can get a $70,000 machine for $600 a month.
Yeah.
I don't like carrying machine notes, but if I buy an expensive machine, I'm going to have to, I wouldn't run it that length.
Yeah.
But man, it's just an old habit. If I can keep, if I don't have a $1,700 a month payment, I'd rather have 600 for a lot of time.
Yeah.
And I know I can deal with it, but it's like an insurance policy. So that I think the financing side would be like, it's the components, right?
That's
three phase, like the, okay. So I can get, if I don't do the super, I can get a mini mill with everything that I want single phase.
Mm-hmm.
Does that matter if I go into a commercial shop? No, but I've gone through three shops and I'm terrified to like, I don't want to have to like do that, not have it work out and come back into a home shop with a mill that won't work.
Yeah. Machine purchases are, they're, I know exactly. I really did go through all that with the Haas, with the mini mill. And at the time, I don't think they had the new mini mill when I bought the X7.
This year.
But I did go through it again with the X9 because the X9, I'm cross shopping it with the VF2.
Right.
Which I went right back to the VF2 because actually, for like a year, I was like, I'll probably get the VF2 after the X7.
Right.
But they hadn't announced the X9.
Right.
And so they announced the X9 and I'm like, yeah, I'll get a VF2. And I'm looking at the X9. I'm like, and it was like for the second time, it's like the mistress appeared. You know what I mean?
Right. Like, it's too like, good. You're like, it is. Yeah. It's an interesting, ultimately the nice thing is like there's so many good options right now. They're good options. It's like, it will work. This is an area where like, do I learn a new system or do I take like the fact that I've just done like a massive amount of learning and just say like, I'm not going to change my CNC.
Yeah.
That's like what I haven't like decided on yet.
One little side note, Tormach just announced their player in this like mini mill, X7 category.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It's not Tormach of old. It's definitely like a legit contender.
Yeah.
But how
does it price compared to, so for me, I probably wouldn't put it on the board.
Because
I never had a Tormach. There's no brand loyalty. Like I have like brand loyalty to Haas, right?
Yeah.
Kind of thing. That could be broken in a way, but it wouldn't be for Tormach.
So the interesting thing about Tormach, so it's epoxy granite frame,
right?
Not saw iron, that. Which is American made frame, which is cool. Machines built in Mexico though.
Okay.
And it is more than a sile.
More than a sile.
Yeah. So it's a little bit more than a sile, and it's like on the margins a little bit less feature rich. So it's like a little bit, it's like the style is definitely still the value buy against that Tormach, the 1500 MX. But the Tormach does have, it is the easiest machine to use in the world, like by far.
I remember seeing like your screen, like your programming screens and stuff and being like, it made me feel like Glowforge.
Yeah, exactly.
Where you're like, this is so plug and play.
Yeah. So if for a first machine.
Yeah.
The 1500 MX for like cutting your teeth where you're not like learning an industrial control at the gate. Cause like the Pathpilot on my Tormach that I have, I love everybody loves Pathpilot.
Yeah.
Like universally, it's like the best control for the beginner. But the Pathpilot that I have, my biggest issue with it is its processing speed is not fast enough for 3D machining like scales. And so we have to, even though the machine can mechanically go faster, we have to limit our feed rates based on what the computer can actually handle.
Oh, wow.
But they've advertised that this new machine has high speed machining, which is essentially a solve for that. But I want to see that that actually works like in real life. I don't know.
Right.
But it's interesting. Like when I saw it, I was like, dang, that's really cool. I really liked my Tormach, but Sile is still the value against it.
That brings up like a real point, which is, so when I bought the Glowforge, my laser friends were like, don't buy a Glowforge. I was like, no, but you don't understand. I'm not good with Illustrator. I don't have a ton of time to like develop a skill set around this machine, but I do need a laser.
Mm-hmm.
And this is very, very user-friendly. So I paid a premium for its user-friendliness.
Mm-hmm.
Just had the same conversation around archery, which was everyone's like, dude, just buy a flagship bow. You're going to get to a point where you're out shooting. And I was like, listen, I'm such a novice. I don't know what I like. I don't even know what I don't like. So if I pick something decent that is super affordable, but like also like, and like has everything I need, right? Like a ready to hunt package, I can pull the string and let an arrow go.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that value proposition is actually the learning tool that I need so that I don't obsess. Like if I were to go like buy a Matthews, I would obsess over how to outfit that bow to a point where it was a problem for my time. Whereas if I buy like a simple, like, you know, bear, I ended up trading incidentally into used bows and I'm psyched because I got like flagship bows that I can just treat like they're starter bows, which is great. But the idea, it's like that ease of use.
Mm-hmm.
If you are limited on time, is a very, very, very valuable component of a first machine purchase.
Yeah. And I will say, like, people have asked me a lot of times, like the X7, they're like, how hard is it to run? Because there's no real, there's minimal content on that control.
Right.
I felt like it was really pretty easy, but I have to remind myself, all I did was Pathpilot gave me all the muscle memory. So it's like, I know what a work offset is. Like before having the Tormach, I didn't know any of this stuff.
Yeah.
Now that I have like the mental model, all I have to do with the Sile control is like overlay this new skin on it.
Yeah.
And it's super easy to understand. But if I didn't have that like substrate of like knowing what the thing is doing,
right,
it would have been quite difficult. So like,
well, that's that like bridging the divide thing, right? Yeah. Like you use something simple, you cross the chasm, you now understand, like, it's funny talking like work offset measures and like understanding how you like, how you do it versus I do it and how I learned it versus how you learned it and stuff. And you're like, once you figure out like what the language difference is, it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Right. If you're learning all of that from scratch in a control that is not as intuitive, that is, it's not that it's impossible. Mm-hmm. It's that we see people struggling with it. Like when you go into the Facebook group, if you're not a machinist and you're trying to like learn the control, that is the value proposition of something like a Tormach.
Yeah.
Right.
So long story short, the 1500 MX, it's very interesting. I think they did a good job. If it actually proves to be what it is marketed as, I still think Tormach's Honey Hole is the sub $15,000 market.
Totally.
So they're smaller, really simple, like they're 770M and like even the 440. Like the really beginner with, because they still get the Pathpilot, which you'll learn everything you would need. But you're only like, for example, if I could give like some advice to myself, like if I had to go back in time, I'd almost consider getting like the smallest machine they have that I could make like a Kydex sheath with.
Yeah.
But then make some scales with it, learn how to run a CNC, then go to like an X7 or a Haas, and keep that little guy for like, that's my Kydex machine. I learned on it.
Yeah.
Whereas right now my MX, the 1100, it was great to learn on because of Pathpilot, but it's way too much machine for Kydex. And it's not enough for anything else.
Right.
So it's like in a really weird spot. Like I like it, but it's like, it doesn't, I don't know where, what it's for. You know what I mean?
That's actually a great bit of advice, which it's like, it's very easy to go to the nth.
Mm-hmm.
Before you even know what you need.
Yeah.
Right. But if you buy, if the goal is to improve, like you're like, what does CNC provide? Okay. It provides automation around something in my shop. if you're making fixed blades, I told this to Maddie the other night, which is like funny, but I was like, okay, two things about this knife that are game changing is like one that I'm hard milling bevels. Okay. That's huge. Handle shaping arguably is maybe more offensive to me as like something that I have to do with my time. Cause it's like, it's dusty. You still require precision. It still takes a lot of hand time. And I look and I'm like, man, if you were a maker and you're having water jet blanks done, you're profiling, you're doing blade grinding, but you had a tiny CNC shaping handles and you're learning CNC with that and 3D modeling.
Yeah.
That right there brings in a level of efficiency that changes how money flows into your business.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Just one thing. It's like, you don't have to get a CNC and start making folders. Right. It's like, you just have to get a CNC and figure out what a work offset is.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And that's where I think Tormach comes in with like the 440 and the 770.
What do those go for at this point?
So if you like a 440 is tiny, right? It's like very like bench top level, and you can get one of those for like $5,000 or $6,000, I think.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's
that's amazing.
It's got the Pathpilot, and then the 770M, like if it was stripped, gutted, just basic, like used under 10, maybe a little over 10, something like that. So you're looking at, like I said, sub $15,000 in the Tormach. Don't option them up. Don't get the tool changer. Don't get the whole everything. Because as soon as you start doing that, you're right up breathing down the neck of a Sile. And at that point, like, absolutely not. Like, you're definitely go to the Sile. You know what I mean?
Well, and that's such, you start to get in, like, depending on who you talk to, it's like, okay, I bought a used Haas. Yeah. So I got a machine that had been inspected by Haas. I bought used. I bought bigger than I really needed at that time because that was like the old advice.
Mm-hmm.
Anymore, man, like, I really think, especially like with knife making or anything like in these like small parts, it's like, you don't necessarily have to follow all of the traditional advice.
Mm-hmm.
If you buy the machine that you can understand and you can afford, it puts you ahead.
Yeah.
If you're forging, you don't have to go get like, all, you know, a huge little giant or, you know, some like vintage hammer and figure out how to restore it.
Mm-hmm.
You can buy a small Anyang.
Yeah.
Like, or, you know, whatever the comparison is. And it's like, because it gets you moving quickly and allows you to keep working.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that is also like in our industry, like the hobby versus like money making mindset in a way where you're like, yeah, but I want to take apart a power hammer. Cool. If that's what you want to do, do it.
Mm-hmm.
The other version is like my craftitalist version where it's like, yeah, I want to do the craft. Yeah. But I want to get paid.
You can either make tools or you can make money.
Yeah. That's right.
Either one's fine, but just
totally fine.
Yeah.
I think we should wrap it on that because that's a sick ender.
That was a good one.
That was fun, man.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Thanks for listening, guys. We've been a little patchy. We've both been kind of got running crazy. Summertime, Mother's Day, you know, all this stuff and a lot of work. So appreciate you guys hanging in there with us. Thanks to you guys and Patreon.
Yep. Saw some new people come into Patreon. Appreciate you. I just went in and checked and I realized there were some threads that I didn't even know about. So I will be a little more active.
Agreed. Same here.
Cool. All right. Good talking to you, man. Thank you guys.
Peace.
Be well.